Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
All right, so now we have Jacob approaching a little bit closer to home, and now he's got this 20-year guilt on his head of everything that he did to Esau. So yeah. Pick us up.
Okay, so really we're in then our last two chapters for today's discussion, chapter 32 of Genesis. Jacob is clearly concerned because last time he was with his brother wanted to kill him. So I'll go back to the King James because it illustrates what I think is happening here very nicely. Genesis chapter 32, verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother. Verse 4, he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau. Thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now." And I jumped back to this because it illustrates what scholars refer to as the messenger formula. We have to recognize that we're dealing with an ancient culture prior to the days of modern communication, whether emails, cell phones, or any other way of communicating over long distances. Therefore, people would send messengers. And it was expected that the messenger would not elaborate into the message any of his own personal feelings or a bias that he had, but would repeat word for word the message that he was sent to convey. And so to express that, he will use first person speech. I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. Now that's Jacob speaking, not the messenger. And to separate this and distinguish and set it up as such, the expression is given, thy servant Jacob saith thus. I have sojourned with Laban, and then the switch to the first-person narrative. So that expression, thy servant Jacob saith thus, again, is the messenger formula, and Hebrew prophets will pick up on this cultural tradition through that famous expression, thus saith the Lord. And so this is a great place to illustrate that.
Interesting.
Sometimes you'll even see it where a messenger comes from the king of Babylon and reports and says, the king of Babylon has said unto you, blah, 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 and it's the messenger formula from the king in the very same scenario through a messenger.
Mm-hmm. Yes, excellent. So verse 6, the messengers return to Jacob and say, we came to thy brother Esau, and he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, there's no response on his part except for to bring 400 men, right? Which is verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two bands, and said, if Esau come to one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. Verse 9, Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saith unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant, and so forth. Deliver me, verse 11, I pray thee from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children.
I'm afraid of what's going on here, so get me out of this jam, God, even though I'm not worthy.
Yep.
So, exactly. All right. Okay, anybody else with comments?
Yeah, I like verse 12, where we're headed with this. We see this repeated over and over and over again. It's back to covenant again. I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered. for a multitude. And
reminding him, this is what you promised me.
Exactly. Exactly, and it's repeated it once again in 37 as we move forward. It's again in 49. It's Isaiah repeats it. It's repeated in the New Testament, isn't it? This statement over and over again.
But here he's trying to hold God to his earlier promise.
Too, exactly.
I'm in a bind. Good.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. So now Jacob's nervous, as we can tell, and he decides some other strategies here of dividing up a lot of the different things that he's going to offer as gifts to Esau to hopefully appease his hunger. And then he wants to put distance in between each one as sort of a way of an early warning system, you know, with him at the back of the pack.
And it's clearly the drama, the tension here for the reader experiencing the first time is really building, right, with these different techniques that he puts together. So we feel concerned about what's going to take place for Jacob. Is he going to, what's God going to do? Is he going to honor the promise? And what's going to happen? Then at that point, we should pick it up then, because as after the other things that he puts together to try and defend the people, we'll pick it up then in verse 22. How about there?
Okay.
So he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons, and he passed over the ford of Jabbok, and he took them and sent them over to the brook and sent over that he had, and Jacob was left alone, verse 24, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now, this is this fascinating story where he will wrestle throughout the night with ultimately a being who will, we will learn, is actually God himself. Verse 25, and when he saw that he prevailed not against him, now the he there is God, ultimately described as the man. He, God, did not prevail against Jacob. Jacob is incredibly powerful and strong. He, God, touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he, God, said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go except thou bless me. And that's where he's going to give him, God will then give him the name, because he successfully wrestles with him and is able to hold on to him until the break of day. And God is going to say, your name will no longer be Trickster or Jacob. Verse 28, thy name shall be called Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And sometimes, because this is such a strange folkloristic account of wrestling with God, modern commentators, especially in the LDS tradition, will try to describe this as a figurative wrestling match as opposed to something literal. I believe that Hugh Nibley went that way and talked about it in terms of the sacred covenantal embrace.
Right, and also the new name, Jacob's name being changed.
Yeah. Exactly. But we're old, and I'm not saying that some of those themes are not there in the narrative of ritualization. They certainly are, but ultimately this is clearly a literal wrestling match that's taking place, because that's why Jacob's thigh is put out of joint.
I personally feel, as a priest in Old Catholic tradition, that what we've done is liturgicalize ancient events that actually happened. And as the story was retold, a theological impetus was placed upon it. We'll see that when we get to the face of God.
Yeah.
Okay, so this limp thing, you really do think, David, there's pretty good textual and other evidence that from this point on, Jacob did have a limp. So it really was an injury that he carried the rest of his life with him.
That's what it's describing for us. And and that's why at the end of the section, in verse 32, we read, therefore, and this is, you know, an etymology for what's going to happen in terms of naming, the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which
right.
is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he, God, touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. So it does give an etymology for this ritual practice that is a custom later in ancient Israel, but again implies a literal wrestling match having taken place.
Yeah. And so the Abraham's servant putting his hand upon underneath Abraham's thigh or grabbing his genitals, you really don't think that that's a similar thing here, that there's a covenant being made between them?
No, well, I think there definitely is a covenant being made here. And I think there, in the same way that we saw ritualization in the deception narrative with Isaac and Jacob, we're seeing that here. And I think Nibley and others have done well to point that out. But I also think, despite the ritualization that is found there, the account is being very literal in a description of a wrestling match where Jacob gets injured.
Okay, so both going on, not one or the other. Okay,
yeah.
Good. Brian, tell us what the heck Midrashim is there on this, as well as anything. Again, this may be back where Muslims also have stuff to say.
We do have a little of both this time on this one. I mean, Muslims don't have a whole lot on Jacob. When we get to Joseph, they got tons, but not a whole lot on Jacob. But I do have a little bit from them, even on this count here. And that is, let's start with the Midrash here. Again, I'm using Google stuff here to help me out on the Midrash. So anybody that's interested, it's Traditions of the Bible. It's really a big, thick book. So it's really well done. He does a really good job of kind of bringing out what the these early interpreters were saying. And we're talking about time period between about 200 BC and 400 AD, somewhere around there. But he brings in early Christian stuff, too. That's really interesting, kind of ties that together. So I've got some stuff for you here is what I'm saying on this one. So with the angel or God struggling or Jacob struggling with the angel or God, the interpreters did have a question. Was it an angel? Is it God? Is it an angel of God? It's, you know, they kind of go back and forth on that. But what they do come down on is this, that most of them conclude that this whole idea of getting his name changed had nothing to do with struggling against God or even an angel of God. It meant that Jacob had been strong with the help of God. Do you see the difference there? That he had been strong with the help of God. And so they, again, it's all this, you know, where you're taking away this tension a little bit, I think, with this means here in terms of wrestling against God. What does that mean? I mean, is God an adversary here? What is that? And they're saying no.
Does that mean they'd be uncomfortable with Abraham bargaining with God and all that stuff too?
No, it sort of seems
the same thing here, that like this is a God that welcomes you pitting yourself against and proving yourself and you know, in some ways proving to yourself who you are through the physicality and through the debate.
Right. And you know, there might be something to that, but in this particular situation, I think they're trying to say that he's strong with God in terms of, you know, he's extremely strong, but we've got him working with God instead of against God, and they seem to want to focus on that.
So in is fact, it really even a wrestling match?
Yeah, to them it doesn't come off as much as a wrestling match as it does as they're kind of working together in some sort of a struggle.
And no injury?
And well, no, there is some idea of an injury a little bit later on. Early Christians took this a little further and said that God and Jacob were struggling together against something or someone else.
Hmm.
So the early Christians kind of take that a little bit further. But then the interpreters really try to focus on not so much the conflict itself, but the fact that in the course of it, Jacob actually saw God's face.
Right.
And so they want to focus on that a little bit more. And so and that by extension for early Christians meant that, well, for Israel means not just Jacob and the Jews, but also the Christians and the church can have a reward of seeing God.
Right, because of the term Penel in the Passover, Abraham spoke face to face with God, and there was covenant and relationship. And later in the Jewish Passover, for the term bread, you know, that would
exactly
mean, you know, face of God. And later in the communion, you know, when we would have our covenantal faith restored face to face, you know, with God. There is this idea that Jacob, you know, wrestled to see the, you know, face of God in this conflict.
Yes, that's exactly right. Now, the early Christians, when they look at Jacob in this wrestle, and they look at the verse about the Jacob being wounded in the thigh, just from Kugel, he says, to Christians who sought in the Old Testament hints or foreshadowings of the New, capital N, these verses were particularly tantalizing since such apparently unnecessary or quizzical passages often had hidden meanings or foreshadowings. The very idea of Jacob having been wounded suggested to some the wounding of Jesus in the crucifixion. And then he quotes Justin Martyr on that, where he refers to that Jacob's thigh being touched and making it grow numb is a symbol or a type of Christ on the cross being wounded. Now, there's another aspect to this, and that is in rabbinic Judaism, the practice of eating meat, okay, especially the sinew of the hip, didn't actually come into being until Sinai and after the Exodus from Egypt. And so the way they explained this earlier rendering of that law is that the law was, they're using verse 32 as an example in a sense. They put it in its place, meaning they put it in Jacob's story to suggest that there's this is why, okay, we don't eat the sinew of the hip, okay? And so they're kind of projecting backwards there. Does that make sense on this whole hip thing?
Yes, it's even in the Hebrew Passover.
Exactly, yes.
But you're basically saying, lest these laws look super arbitrary, whenever I can, I'm going to ground it in some earlier story.
Exactly. So yeah. They're grounding it in the story. Yeah. Now, for Muslims, it's just better just to kind of read what one Muslim says here. Jacob was returning from Haran, heading toward Jerusalem. At the time, he was fleeing from his brother Esau. He was a strong man, and on the way, he met an angel. And Jacob thought that he was a robber, so he wrestled with him. The angel injured Jacob's thigh and then ascended into the sky. Jacob looked and saw that his sciatic sinew was inflamed. In consequence of this, there was great pain. He could not sleep at night from the pain, and he passed the night screaming. So Jacob swore that if God cured him, he would not eat sinews and would not eat food in which there were sinews. He prohibited it himself. Following him, his children removed the sinews from meat. So there's this dietary thing there. But apparently Jacob got sciatic nerve damage on that.
Interesting.
Yeah. So interesting stories here.
Tom, anything else that excites you about this story? Are there any angles that we haven't covered?
No, just the thigh issue and how that results in an echo in Revelation chapter 3, verses 10 through 14, which is where he nibbly goes with it. And I think there was some early Christian liturgies that actually said that we wrestle with God, that we actually struggle to know God, and that's where righteousness and the new name of the royalty will come from when our struggle is over. And they used to use Revelation 3:10 through 14 to result in our new creation to come. So these echoes just seem to be echoing, you know, through Scripture over and over and over again. And I couldn't agree more that oftentimes they do begin from a literal story.
Interesting. Well, nobody's really brought it up. I guess I sort of did in a little bit of a comment, but, you know, again, I've mentioned before, I love this piece from Sunstone by Rick Jepson, and it's about God wrestling, and it's about the Jacob story. But it basically talks about the redemptive nature of physical struggle. You know, when you actually fight, when you wrestle, you discover who you are. You know, you discover your strength if you were to wrestle for a couple of hours or all night. You know, this Rick Jepson, who wrote this article, is a wrestler. And he says, you know, even after just a few minutes, you know, your lungs are burning, your legs are aching, you can't stand it. And to have to wrestle for all night is like an unthinkable thing. And he talks about these famous wrestling matches throughout history where you get a sense of, you know, somebody at the end of this, you know, one of the wrestlers says, I think I'll never be such a good man as I was again, as I was during this struggle. In other words, after an ordeal like this, there's no higher level of proving myself that I could ever get to. And David, tying back to you in the Gilgamesh epic, don't we have Gilgamesh, who's sort of a scoundrel and he's sort of a tyrant and things like this, but then it's his wrestling match with Enkidu that he becomes a good man, or he begins to start taking on the more heroic qualities.
Interesting, yes. That's a great connection. Hadn't thought of that one.
And so this Rick Jepson's whole thing is, you know, he talks about Joseph Smith's physicality. He's got some interesting things about Muhammad. Apparently he did some wrestling and was sort of known for that sort of things. You know, Joseph Smith says, you know, when he gets criticized for always wrestling with the young men and stuff, he says, "Brother, this is what draws them to me, the fact that we can prove ourselves against each other in these wrestles." And, you know, that's how you get to know anybody. I think there was some quote that he gave in there about, you know, it was Plato says, "You can learn more about a man in 1 hour of play with him," meaning wrestling, "than you can in a year of conversation." And so Rick's whole thing is this, you know, this redemptive struggle, or this struggle is a redemptive one. And even that, it's like the new name comes when he truly has overthrown the supplanter, the trickster, the things of his past. And he becomes a new man here that, you know, is somebody who strives with God and wins. And, you know, certainly there's some deceit. You know, when he and Esau finally get together, he sort of says, "Yeah, we'll visit again. I'll come back and visit you." And of course he never does. And things like this, but Jacob does seem to be like a different person from here on out, and so I think it's important to kind of look at physical struggle as a pathway towards spiritual enlightenment and growth. And
excellent commentary.
It's a great piece. I hope you guys have read it. I'll definitely link to it. I've probably linked to it to half a dozen of my podcasts again, because it was really wonderful. You know, last time I mentioned how this idea of Isaac favoring Esau over Jacob because he was so unlike him, you know, whereas Jacob was probably much more the way Isaac was, which is more passive and timid and things like this. Well, this Rick Jepson, as he wrote the article, he says it really dawned on him, and it became very, very personal, because this Rick says that, you know, his whole life he was trying to get the favor of his father, and he never could. And yet his younger brother, who is bigger and stronger, and like he says, even as a kid, he comes out, you know, is talking about, "I'm going to beat your brains to the moon," you know, to the moon. And he goes, and this guy is in the army, and he's driving Humvees, and he's doing all these things while I sit there guzzling soda at the keyboard. And he says, you know, and my father, you know, basically has these teary-eyed feelings for this wild and crazy son, and yet I'm the one who is so much more like my father, you know. And just this idea of struggling for his dad's approval would be one of the demons that Jacob is like fighting in this thing, you know. He says perhaps he's fighting against this overbearing mother that kind of smothered him. And so he basically has this really wonderful piece in this article about all the different, you know, people and haunting events from your life and past that, you know, through physical wrestle you can kind of defeat. It's just a beautiful piece. I'll let it go from there. But there is one positive thing that I'm going to bring it up at Sunstone this week when I go there. I'm going to tell a little bit about the story of this article. But one of my favorite passages in the entire piece is because it was the discovery of a metaphor. So I know lots of people who listen to this podcast have maybe heard this before, but he goes, "As I face an opponent, one of the strongest positions I can obtain is wrapping both arms around his torso and hugging him in tightly. I can then dump him, trip him, or throw him, but will remain in that embrace. and regardless of whom or what I may be fighting, I can also choose the same approach. And so he uses this idea of a metaphor as hugging and embracing while you're also striving against them as a stance to take with God and to with the church and with anything that you struggle with or things like this, that, you know, you're pitting yourself against it, and at the same time that you're pummeling it and whatnot, you are, you know, you're embracing it. And is this one of the best metaphors of my life that came out of this? And he goes on to say, he says, I suspect it was the same thing with Jacob. As he wrestled with all the 100 faces that met him, he tried to overcome but not obliterate them. He still loved his brother, his mother, his self, and his God. So he wasn't kicking or eye gouging. So this idea that, you know, he wasn't cheating, but he was still fighting with all of them. And I just love this metaphor of embracing while also struggling. So
yeah, that is absolutely beautiful. Thank you, Dan, for bringing that to our attention. I love that idea.
That's
clearly good. clearly taking this ancient, you know, folkloristic tradition of, and you brought up Gilgamesh, and there are lots of cases in the ancient Near East of people literally struggling with gods and fighting them and showing how powerful they are and significant, and it seems to play upon that sort of motif and to take it and to give it theological depth and meaning for a contemporary experience with divinity. I loved that. That was beautiful.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to have a chance to bring that up. You know, I'll just, while we're going personal here a little bit, you know, there was, you know, a lot of people have talked to me. I've talked a lot about my faith crisis and journey and whatnot, and how it was 10 or 12 years of struggle where I really sometimes didn't know which way was up and whether I'd be able to, you know, stay with the saints or if there was a God or what this God was like. And, you know, I was just so lost for so many years, and yet, you know, each along the way, there would just be these glimpses of hope. I'd get a little bit of energy here or a little bit of a message, and it would break through. But, you know, by the time I was done, not that I'm done, obviously, growing and wrestling with God and things like this, but I tell you, you know, that section 121 where it talks about having confidence in the presence of God and things like this, that's, you know, I'm not there, but I'm so much more there because of my wrestle than I would ever be when I had never a doubt. And I, you know, a testimony before where I might say the exact same things and use the language because it's familiar, you know, in the ritual settings in which we bear testimony and whatnot within Mormonism. I may say the same sort of things, but there's just such a different level of like what I mean behind those. And I hope it comes across, and I sense that I can tell when somebody has been through a war and somebody who hasn't. You know, it's after the wrestle that, you know, this new name that you have, this new, it is a new confidence with God and with the universe. I don't know. There's just something that comes from the God wrestle.
Well, I think it's real faith and character are developed in these lifelong quests and struggles.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is, what did Paul say? We work out our spiritual journey with fear and trembling. So it's, faith can be a real struggle.
And in the Greek, there is some meaning of, you know, literally working out like an Olympiad in that case.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's great. Fun to throw all this junk in there. Not junk, as in, but just this extra stuff that's on my heart all the
time.
Now,
we've got to be careful, guys, on a lighter note, when we talk about bearing testimony, you know, because in the first century, it meant we went before a magistrate or a judge, and we had our lower extremities open, you know, from the word testes and testosterone, you know, that kind of worked its way into bearing our testimony. And so we got to be careful that, you know, the ancient biblical meanings have changed quite a bit. And I just say that with a great deal of humor.
and we do take that leap of faith and expose our innermost thoughts and feelings to an audience about divinity. So
exactly, and it comes after you've shown yourself fully to God. You know, that's what it is. You know, there's no more hiding place or something when you're in the battle. You know,
no, we can't hide.
You know, and you know, even in sports and whatnot, you know, win, lose, and stuff like that to the athletes, certainly they're competitive and they want to win. But how often do you hear them just saying, I'm satisfied if I laid it all out on the line? You know, that's what matters, is it's how we fight, not necessarily the outcome of a fight. And all of that kind of stuff of just proving who we are through how we handle struggle is just huge.
And I think one of the biggest crimes in today's cheap instant Christianity is we want to take the wrestling with faith out of the equation.
Yeah, we just want answers. Give me the answers.
Yeah, where God becomes a genie in a bottle, you know, just fix me, you know. And it's a sign of faith if he'll step in and fix me or fix the problem immediately, when really our character, our growth, our struggle for faith, even growth in our personal identity. I know with the physical, you know, issues I've struggled with since birth has given me, you know, insights into the emotional, the spiritual, and the soul struggle that we struggle with for completion. I think what you folks are saying are right on, and we can't hide from God. And our testimony shows all that we are. No pun intended.
Yeah. Brother Tom, I'm not sure that most of the audience are aware that you have just one arm and about your vision troubles. Do you want to share it all?
Well, basically, I was a preemie baby in 1954. There wasn't a lot of babies who could survive being born at less than 2 pounds. I was called the miracle baby in our family because, you know, when they would give you too much oxygen or, you know, and they'd have to do it to keep you alive or you'd die, you know, it would ruin your optic nerves and you'd get nystagmus and double vision and other things. But the lungs wouldn't always work, you know. So I was in an isolette till April. And, you know, one leg is slightly shorter than the other, so I've got, you know, back pains and things that I deal with when I walk and run because of the imbalance that is caused, you know, in the upper torso. And so I had to learn to ride a motorcycle one-handed, a bicycle, and became a disc jockey and a professional singer in the nightclub arena. And I could do what I wanted to do, but it took a great deal of self-acceptance I had to learn. I had to get over the struggles from peers and, you know, the name calling and find my wholeness and just kind of turn the other way and learn to be part of the gang and, you know, go forward and battle, you know, the misconcepts my parents had in trying to make me a tough guy. And so I had a lot of layers of stuff to really work through. But I can truly say, as you do that, that's where you find your joy and your happiness. And you do really enjoy the relationships that you gain when you finally win the respect of your peers and colleagues. Then they kind of look at amazement at you with, you know, what has been accomplished. And then you battle those who say, well, you'll never amount to anything. And so when you're a young little lad, you have to work through all of this. It's either that or you lay down and die. You know, you give it up or you go into drugs or immorality or something like that. And I never saw that as a good option. So I've had to be a fighter my entire life through. But then you've got to learn when to rest and, you know, when to just enjoy life and not be an intense person, you know, all the time, you know, but relax and then just be part of the gang as well.
Thank you. Well, we sure admire you, because what you've accomplished out of the tough circumstances are just impressive, amazing. And clearly a spiritual giant emerged. So thank you, brother.
Well, thank you. thank you. And it should, you know, give people a lot of insight into the struggles that other people endure. And it should produce compassion, you know, rather than simply anger and a feeling of being ripped off, you know, in life.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, guys. David, take us home. Jacob and Esau finally meet. All the worry was for nothing. Tell us what happens.
Okay. And before we do, maybe just to follow up on what we've talked about so far, because I just really wanted to make it clear to our audience that it is literally Yahweh or God that he is wrestling with. Sometimes there's some confusion because he's described as a man. But we've already emphasized that he says, I have seen the face of God. And there's an interesting connection that we should draw attention to in Hosea chapter 12, where Hosea is going to talk about the same tradition of Jacob wrestling with God. In chapter 12, verse 3, we read in the King James, he, Jacob, took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel. Notice he's called a malach, or an angel, and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. Even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is his memorial. And here it does seem to indicate, from Hosea's perspective, that this is even the angel is Yahweh, is God himself. So it's a bit confusing. There's an interesting book that came out a few years ago by a Jewish biblical scholar by the name of Benjamin Sommer, and it's entitled The Bodies of God and the World of Ancient Israel. And he describes this reference here, but also in other cases where we have Yahweh identified as a malach, as an angel, as, well, he takes an interesting approach to it. He says, he writes this on page 41, he is Yahweh, but is not, meaning he, the angel, is Yahweh, but is not all of Yahweh, or the only manifestation of Yahweh. Rather, he is an avatar, a descent of the heavenly God, who does not encompass all of that God's substance, either a localized and perhaps temporary manifestation of the deity, that is the result of fragmentation of the divine self, wrestles with Jacob or speaks with Abraham, as the case may be. So it's an interesting theory where he kind of takes this of avatar and applies it to the Hebrew Bible, where Yahweh can have different manifestations of himself bodily as a man or as an angel, as the case may be.
But you don't necessarily agree with him on that. You'd think that the writer of this wasn't like imagining that Yahweh laid apart some of his divinity to come down and do this. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's an interest. I wouldn't go there. No, I think despite my interest in the theory, and I think it's a wonderful book. I'm a little bit skeptical of applying the Indian concept of avatar here to Yahweh. But it is a possibility that we have, because remember, there are other instances where Yahweh comes and appears as an angel, and, you know, there are, it's a possibility to interpret it that way. But however one would go, whether it's a manifestation of Yahweh or Yahweh himself, he is supposed to be interpreted as a wrestling match, that it is supposed to be interpreted as a wrestling match which takes place with divinity, and there is some confusion on that, so...
Yeah, no, that's good. So Yahweh walks with them in the garden. He shows up as a visitor to Abraham. Now we've got him here. So we have a pretty, the J writer, I'm assuming, is the writer in all of those. And for this person, Yahweh is deity, he's God. But is he still just one of the council of gods, but he's the toughest one? Or do we have any sense at this time of the way that, you know, we've gone to these extreme, you know, high, high God, you know, beyond all category kind of stuff?
Yeah, he is definitely in this case. And I would probably link this section with Jay in Genesis chapter 32. And he's described initially as a man. And you've pointed out, yes, it's in J where man is going to, or God is going to walk in the cool part of the day, where in J, in the Noah pericope, he will literally come down and shut the lid of the ark for Noah.
Oh.
So God is very anthropomorphic in this tradition, and as an anthropomorphic being can have this very physical wrestling match with Jacob.
Okay, but is he just one of the many gods?
Yes.
When we talk about the council for this writer, and it's later when we get to the, you know, the Exodus stuff that he becomes like the only god.
Yeah, he literally says, "I have seen Elohim face to face, yet my life was saved." In 32, verse 31, and the word Elohim can refer either to God or to lower ranking divine beings.
Because
even in the Genesis material, we have a vacillation between, you know, singular and plural, and Eloheinu, you know, our God answers the one God in that vacillation, and then Elohim can be the mighty council, and they all sang, or they all said, you know, and then Yahweh in the singular does his speaking.
Yeah, and going back to Hosea 12:4-6, I read the King James translation, but it's poetic parallelism, and I would probably translate that looking at the Hebrew as something like, in his strength he wrestled Elohim. He wrestled a Moloch, an angel, and prevailed. It was Yahweh, the God of hosts. Yahweh was his name.
Hmm.
So here, Hosea is trying to make clear this tradition of a wrestling match that takes place with the highest of the Elohim, or the gods, Yahweh, the head of the council. Very anthropomorphic being.
Right. So no need, again, I'm just going off that commentary that you read, no need to imagine the, you know, beyond all comparison God that would then have to limit themselves for the J writer. It really doesn't match up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Brian, anything before we head on to the meeting of Jacob and Esau?
No, let's move on.
Awesome. David, take us into their reunion.
Okay. So in Genesis chapter 33, looking up, Jacob, after this wrestling match, where now his name has been changed from the trickster to Israel, is still called by the narrator Jacob, however, at this point. But Dan, you did well to emphasize his very nature through this experience will change. No longer will he be associated with deception, but rather with one who strives with and contends with God himself. Jacob saw Esau coming, accompanied by 400 men. He divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maids, putting the maids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. So, again, quite sad, but if he's going to lose someone, it's not going to be Rachel and Joseph. He himself went on ahead and bowed low to the ground 7 times until he was near his brother. Esau ran to meet him. And at that point, we wonder what is going to happen. Is he going to kill him? Because that's what he threatened to do the last time they were together. But then the narrator adds, he embraced him, falling on his neck, he kissed him, and they wept. And it's a beautiful scene of reconciliation and forgiveness where Esau demonstrates his love for brother. And verse 5, looking about, he saw the women and the children. Who, he asked, are these with you? And Jacob answered, the children with whom God has favored your servant. He calls him that despite the blessing that had been given to him, where Esau, remember, is destined to be the servant of Jacob. And then each of the children and the maids follow, and they bow down, and he says this. Esau, verse 9, Esau said, I have enough, my brother, let what you have remain yours, because Jacob has offered reconciliation gifts to him. But Jacob said, no, I pray you, if ye would do me this favor, accept from me this gift, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God.
Who I just happened to see last night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And who I wrestled with and now am, you know, am one with. now the same thing has happened with us in our lives. So there's a comparison between Esau and God here that he makes that is quite beautiful and profound.
So quite the 20 years for Esau in this period of time, from anger to growing prosperous himself, and all those different things. I just really admire him. I love the redemption of Esau.
Yeah, it's a beautiful redemption. We've talked about this in previous podcasts where, you know, sometimes our focus is on Isaac and not Ishmael, and Jacob and not Esau. But these other people, as we've discussed, are chosen sons as well, who have a role to play.
I love that, David, just to show how everybody is on their own journey, you know, and here we have Esau with his own journey, and clearly he went through a lot to get there. Now, there's also a tie-in here. Remember when Isaac blessed Esau, you know, after he's all distraught about Jacob getting the good blessing, there was this bit about, you know, you will be a prosperous guy, you will enjoy the fat of the land, something about at some point you will break off the shackles of your brother. And clearly that's happened here, right?
He's
somehow part of the shackle almost could be the psychological shackle of the resentment.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Are there lots of people that connect this with, clearly this is that blessing fulfilled?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, and that's why also I emphasized the concept of servant. And he says, I am your servant, which is a, you know, turnaround from the actual blessing itself, where Esau was promised that he would, when he asked for the blessing, he's like, you're going to be a servant to your brother. Well, he doesn't have as high a status, but still Jacob kind of reverses that by calling him his servant. It's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this nice reconciliation, and then they decide to go their separate ways.
And just to jump in back at this point, for our LDS audience, I think it's worth noting that there is a beautiful connection between this section of Genesis and the book of Enos. And I'll just do it really quickly, if that's all right, Dan, because I think it's fascinating. But remember, Enos is the son of Jacob in the Book of Mormon, who's named after this biblical patriarchal figure. And Enos is the one who tells us, in verse 2 of the Book of Mormon, I will tell you of the wrestle which I had before God, before I received a remission of my sins. So really, the only other reference in Scripture we're going to have to this concept of a wrestling, but here he takes it figuratively of wrestling before God. But it's clearly an allusion back to the Genesis story, because then it continues in verse 3, I went to hunt beast in the forest. And, of course, Esau is the hunter. And here Enos links himself, based upon this connection, it would seem, with Esau, the hunter, as opposed to Jacob, the plain man of the tents. But the other interesting thing happening here is that in so doing, I believe Enos is linking himself with his forsaken brothers, the Lamanites. For if there's one thing that happens in the Book of Mormon in terms of the stereotypical Lamanite, it's that the Lamanite is a good hunter. He's good with the bow. Even in this account of Enos, they are going to, in verse 19, they're going to wander about in the wilderness, and they're going to feed upon beasts of prey and skilled in this way. So it's a stereotypical Lamanite. So Enos seems to be linking himself by going into the wilderness to hunt for beasts. Otherwise, why would that little literary element even be necessary? Why wouldn't he just say, I was in the forest, or I was walking along? But to add that hunting motif in, I think it needs to connect back with the Genesis account. And ultimately, at the end then of Enos, he's going to tell us in verse 27, I will soon go to the place of rest, which is my Redeemer, for I know that in him I shall rest, and I rejoice in the day when my mortal shall put on immortality and shall stand before him. Then shall I see his face, which seems to be an allusion back to Jacob seeing the face of God, I believe, back in, when he calls it, I've called the place Peniel, I've seen the face of God. And I, Enos states, will see his face with pleasure. And he will say unto me, come unto me, ye blessed. There is a place prepared for you in the mansion of my fathers. Now, LDS scholar John Twetness and others have talked about a lot of literary connections between this Enos account and what we've just discussed in Genesis chapter 32. Why I like that is, assuming that those are legitimate and intended in the text, then we have something happening here and perhaps is Enos hoping for a reconciliation between these groups of brothers, the Lamanites and the Nephites, comparable to the type of reconciliation between Jacob and Esau that is described in that Genesis narrative. Anyway, it's a fascinating a topic for a Latter-day Saint to explore.
Yeah. No, nice. Thank you. That's a great sidebar there.
Yeah.
Super. All right. Anything else in this account here? They decide to take leave of each other, and Jacob moves on. And
I have just a little bit, if you're interested,
from
our Muslim friends. Just on the meeting between Esau and Jacob, we have an account here, Okasai, who talks about Esau coming out against him with his soldiers to take possession and kill Jacob. When they came to a mountain, Jacob approached Esau with the power of prophethood, lifted him from the ground, flung him down, and sat on his chest. So that's a wrestling match there, I think.
Yeah.
Esau wept so that Jacob felt compassion for him and let him up, embracing him. Esau said, "My brother, absolve me of what I have done to you, for God has set you above me by giving you prophethood and apostleship. Ask forgiveness for me." Jacob did pray for him and said, "Be of good cheer, for God will make prophets of your progeny, among them Job, a prophet and also a king who will rule the east and west and who will be called Dhul-Qarnayn." Then they bid each other farewell, and Esau returned to his country. Now, Dhul-Qarnayn, usually in the Islamic sources, is Alexander the Great. So,
wow. Okay, interesting. So, again, this would have been a healing that takes place miraculously rather than over the course of 20 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Is there anything else in chapter 33 where we decided to end that anybody would like to bring up?
Later on in the Hebrew Bible, the term pitching a stake or a tent in the Bilidu of Isaiah will be used from this passage to show that when we're in covenant, when we're in favor with God. Now, this isn't the meaning of the passage here, but it's used from this passage to actually show that our faith will not be blown like a Bedouin tent peg, you know, in the desert, or the tents will be run, you know, blown around every which way, that we will be steadfast, not by blown by every wind of doctrine. And it's interesting how tents in Padan Aram, they're camped before the city. And he bought a piece of the land where he pitched his tent by the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father. And it talks about, you know, the money they gave, and they erected an altar and what they called it. You know, it seems like after every act would be completed, and there would be an altar erected or a pillar. And once again, it goes back to this worship imagery, doesn't it? Even at the very end of the chapter.
Fun to always hear how stuff gets used out there for centuries and all throughout the tradition. So, Tom, thanks for always bringing that to us. Dudes, thank you. Wow, 3 hours here today, or close to that. So what stamina, what great friends you are. What a blessing all your knowledge is to the audience here that listens to these. So thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And it's great to journey with great brethren in the Lord, and we hope that our audience can journey with us.
Yeah, thank you, especially Father Tom, for opening up and sharing, you know, your personal narrative that I'm sure was inspiring to our audience. I know it's very helpful to me, and I'm grateful, Dan, for the way that you put this podcast together and give us a chance to learn from one another. Boy, that was just a beautiful conclusion that you provided this narrative as you applied it to the contemporary struggles that we all have with institutional churches and with our relationship to divinity, and yet trying to push forward and have our natures changed. I'm very grateful for what I've learned from you all.
Amen.
It's been a pleasure, gents.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.